And today we have not only a very talented and beautiful lady, but she's also a Lady Lush, a staff member from New York, Hazel Rice. Give her.
That's a good way to start, anyway. Speaking of being a lush, huh? Anyway, my foot fell asleep, I guess. I guess I was so entranced by all these wonderful speakers up here and all the wonderful things that I've heard since I've been here. I could certainly never find words to express my gratitude. But I think, like all of the other wonderful things in AA, each one of you share it with me. So I don't believe I have to really even try to express it. As Cliff has said, my name is Hazel Rice, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
A very grateful alcoholic. Because as of this morning when I awakened, I had what I've come to know as a spiritual awakening. A spiritual awakening because I awakened with a desire to be sober. How many times did I try to wake up? How many times did I try to get up off the floor? How many times did I hope and pray I wouldn't fall out of bed? How many times did I wish that I really were awake and really alive? And yet I knew I was dead. But this morning that was different. And I hope I never cease to forget and cease to be grateful when I awaken in the morning for the fact that I'm one of God's chosen, I would say, because I have the only qualification for membership to AA, a desire to be sober. Sometimes I think I skip over that rather lightly. And I only can do that if I forget the life that I had prior to this morning when I awakened and the many mornings that I've had prior to this morning, with a desire to be sober and AA to make it possible. I didn't come to my first meeting like a lot of you have. And so many of you have shared your experience, strength, and hope so beautifully here. And say, I'm home, and this is great, and this is wonderful. And I'm so glad I found AA. It's just for me. But unlike the very high percentage of people in AA, I'm happy to say, I came to meetings for about 3 years and sat in the back of the room. I guess that's why I have kind of a phobia now about trying to get on the front row. I sat in the back, and instead of listening to the speakers, I used to sit there and wonder what in the world it would be like to think I was an alcoholic. And also what in the world it would be like to feel like these people did who said they were so happy in AA. I couldn't understand. And as I sat there and wondered what it would be like to be an alcoholic, I'd like to share with you what being an alcoholic means to me. And I like to keep this in mind each morning as I ask God for help to keep me away from the first drink today. I happen to have been a registered nurse. When I was going through training, and I think we've heard a few other people say these things, when they were in a particular type of training, they heard nothing of the disease of alcoholism. I don't have to bother telling you that I didn't graduate from training last week. I graduated, I'm sure, as I look back on it now, in the dark ages, as far as the medical professions being informed on the disease of alcoholism. I'm happy to say that as of today, this is not as true as it was then. And I hope I won't sound smug if I voice my own personal opinion, which says that I think it was the recoveries of AA cause the medical profession, the nurses, the doctors, and so forth, to take another look at the disease of alcoholism, because now they could begin to identify it really as a disease. Because, you know, it's a little hard to discover a disease unless you have a recovery. And I believe that the early members of our fellowship did us a very, very large favor in their recovery as far as the example that they set for our wonderful non-AA friends. I don't believe that there's a non-alcoholic in the world that wouldn't be happy to help an alcoholic. Because I have never known of any disease where the person is as ill or as lonely or as boxed up as a sick alcoholic. But the problem is, at least in my case, the big problem was that I couldn't let them help me for a long, long time. I mentioned my being in nursing because I'd like to talk a little bit about my attitude toward alcohol at that time. I grew up in a family of 7 children. I'm the second oldest. Now, there may have been drunks in our neighborhood. There may have been people in our among our acquaintances that drank, but I didn't know them. My father, I understand, was at one time maybe an alcoholic. I don't know. But he stumbled in, it seems, to a tabernacle one night where Billy Sunday was preaching. He had a spiritual conversion and never drank from that day on. So I sort of assume, and maybe I kind of hope, that he was an alcoholic, because I think alcoholics are kind of special. But this was something that was in the past. I was very young when this happened, so I really have not much recollection of it. Everything concerning alcohol in our household and among all of my acquaintances in school and in church was based on a moral issue. It was morally wrong to take the first drink, that's for sure. Now, I'm real happy to say, and I have an idea that Father Barney and Father Fred and Maury and everybody else will be happy to know that I am a Baptist. Maybe I should say I was a Baptist. I love the Baptist Church. I have absolutely nothing against them. And I might truthfully say that if I had followed their suggestions, I would have missed a great deal because I wouldn't have been here today, that's for sure. However, during these years of growing up and being very active in the Baptist Church, our family were active. You talk about action in AA, we were active in the church. We were always there, that's for sure. But it seems like we had a lot of activity, but not very much religion as far as I was concerned. For some reason or other, it didn't seem to penetrate as it should. I didn't quite really go along with all the things that they suggested. So later, when I went into nurses' training, I kind of departed from that atmosphere. And I didn't have my first drink until after I finished training. But during my years in training, particularly when I was working in the emergency room at the hospital, I met up with a lot of drunks. And they bewildered me. They puzzled me. I couldn't understand what in the name of God was wrong with them. They were here last week with a broken arm. Now they're back with a banged up head. They all knew that it came about as a result of their drinking. So why in the world are they drinking? I couldn't understand it. Now I trained in an Episcopal hospital, and they insisted that we be very nice to our patients. If we weren't nice to them, we got kicked out of training. So I could not be unkind to these people. But I really was, frankly, very bewildered by them. They bothered me a great deal. I know now why they bothered me. But I didn't know then that not too many years later, I was going to wake up on a stretcher in one of the city hospitals of New York City with a nurse standing over me with a cup of black coffee with the same look of bewilderment on her face that I had had on mine. And she said to me, Hazel, how in the name of God did you end up here? I didn't know the answer to that question at that time, and she didn't either. I remember, too, that one night I wasn't supposed to go home. I was working 3 to 11. But I had a special date, and I decided I'd go home and spend the night with my family instead of staying in the hospital like I was supposed to. So I got expelled from training for that just 6 weeks before I was to graduate. But I didn't take a very dim view of this at all, because I felt very superior to the people who were going to stay there. And the main reason I felt superior to them was because some of them drank and smoked, and I didn't. And the superintendent of nurses called me into her office, and she said, you know, I won't bother telling you all the things she said. But she pointed out to me that she was very sorry that she was going to have to make this example of me because, you know, I happened to be president of my senior class. And she felt that my example wasn't particularly good. And I mentioned that I was president because I was always either president or sitting in the corner. I didn't know how to be part of a group. And when she got all finished with her nice long lecture, I said, well, I did it and I can take the punishment, you know. My whole career going down the drain 6 weeks before graduation. But very determined not to allow her to suspect that I might care even a little bit. I said, you've got a lot of girls here who do a lot worse things than I've ever done. And she was a very brilliant woman. I realize that now. Because she looked at me and she said, you wouldn't like for me to compare you with them, would you? Well, I had no answer to that, so I walked out. 2 days later, she reinstated me. By the grace of God, I'm sure. And I finished my nurse's training. And then came the time when I had my first drink. This was when I was 23 years of age. And from that night on, I never again went along with anybody who had anything unkind to say about alcohol. Because I had a feeling that they really didn't know what they were talking about at all. Because that was the beginning of the great love affair of my life. The love affair that you and I think, have had with alcohol. As I say, I didn't know anything about alcoholism until I came here. It was here that I learned that as an alcoholic, I have a physical allergy to alcohol. Now, this is terribly important to me. It may not be important to you at all. It's important to me because I think it's the thing I did not accept for so long. I had some kind of an idea that if this were different or that were different or something else were different, I would be able to control my drinking. Today, thanks to AA, I believe that I only have a choice as to how much I'm going to drink before I have the first drink. And once I have that drink, then I no longer really have a choice. Because I believe that something physical happens within me which causes me to be unable to control the amount of drinking I'm going to do then. I found out, too, that I was not wrong, that there is a mental part of my alcoholism. This came as no shock to me. I was not at all surprised. I had known for many, many years that anyone who continued to drink as I did, in spite of the record, was, to say the least, a little bit balmy. No question in my mind about this. But I had talked to some people about this part of my problem. I can almost sort of jokingly say I talked to a psychiatrist. I never told a psychiatrist the truth, ever. But I tried. You see, I don't think that I really meant to lie to the psychiatrist. I don't think I really meant to lie to anybody that I went to talk to. I would love to have had the gift of being able to tell them the truth. But I couldn't. My affair with alcohol was a very personal, private affair. It was all locked up inside me, and I could not discuss it with anybody. We talk a lot about honesty in AA. We talk about perhaps the sick alcoholics who could not be honest. I couldn't be honest, not at that phase. I just couldn't. Maybe I wanted to, maybe I didn't. I choose to feel that as of those moments, I didn't have the great gift that I have today of a desire to be sober. But as I was going to these people, you know, sometimes they ask you why you're doing what you're doing. I found the number of people who asked me about this were less and less all the time. Because you come to the stage in your drinking where people don't care any longer, they can't care. But when people asked me, I would dream up all kinds of excuses. Because if you're an alcoholic like I was and you're planning on continuing to drink, you have to have a fairly good reason for it. So I used to say, well, you know, I had a good job and I gave it up and I married this man and he thought I was pretty wonderful. He doesn't seem to think I'm very wonderful anymore, so who wouldn't stay drunk the rest of their life over this? Or I was very attached to my mother. And she died very suddenly in a diabetic coma, so who wouldn't stay drunk, you know, forever over this? Or my kid sister, who I was very fond of, had run off and married some man that I didn't think was deserving of her at all, so who wouldn't stay drunk, you know, forever over this? But all the time, even as I was dishing out these reasons, I knew they weren't true. But I didn't know the truth. And so I used them rather than not say anything. I came to know the truth when I came here. That the mental part of my alcoholism, as far as I'm concerned, was the fact that I was escaping from myself. And this is why, to me, AA has, and will, I hope, always continue to make my recovery possible. Because here are many, many, many tools that can help me to learn to know myself. And through learning to know a little about myself, learn to live so that I don't have to reach for the first drink. That's why AA is so important to me. As I say, I had my first drink when I was 23. In that same year, I left home. I left Cincinnati, Ohio, which was my home, and went to Chicago and joined the airlines as a stewardess. Now, I literally and figuratively took to the air at that stage of the game, no question about that. I found a completely and very satisfying to me new way of life. And for the next 11 years, I worked in that field. And for the next 11 years, I drank with other people. I don't believe I was ever more sociable after I had a drink than I was before. Because every time I had a drink, I could hear my mother saying, "Hazel, always be a lady." And my father saying, "If you're only half the lady your mother's always been, you'll be all right." Now, I had a sneaking idea that neither one of them would have thought I was following their instructions when I took the first drink. And yet I did. I mention this now because of the fact that this was a very frustrating thing to me. I've had a lot of people ask, and I'm sure you have too, whether you think it's more difficult for a female, as Chuck calls us, a female and a male alcoholics we have, to accept their alcoholism and accept AA as a means of recovery for themselves than it is for a man. Personally, and again, I don't have to bother telling you the things I say are my own opinion, I don't believe so. Because I have a feeling that the recognition and acceptance, the great gift that comes to an alcoholic, which brings them a desire to be sober through AA, is above and beyond any recognition of whether you're male, female, teenager, whatever you are. But if you'll let me indulge in a little self-pity, I would like to say that I think being an act active female alcoholic is a lot more difficult than being an active male alcoholic. At least this was my experience. When you go out on a date, I think, I'm not quite sure whether this is customary out here or not, but where I was living and drinking, it was customary for you to wait until you were asked if you'd like to have a drink. Now, if you'd like to sneak out to the bar quietly and have one, you could do that, but I found that people took a rather dim view of that. They didn't like it very much. And so I think perhaps that was one of the reasons that I was never more sociable after I had a drink than I was before, because I sort of departed usually from the people that had brought me unless they drank as much as I did. I always was very uncomfortable and unhappy at parties, too, where very often they would offer double drinks and triple drinks and drinks for the road and all kinds of special drinks to the men. They didn't usually remember to include the ladies who were present in these great offerings of theirs. And how I used to envy the ladies. They used to sit there, and I'd get a little irritated with them occasionally because the host or hostess would come along and say, "Would you like a drink?" Well, in the first place, it would take them a half hour to make up their mind whether they'd like to have a drink or not. And then they would say, "Well, maybe a little sip of sherry." Well, I always envied those little sip of sherry ladies and wished that I really and truly could have said that and meant it. Because I felt that it would be a little unbecoming to say I'd like to have a tumbler of gin, if you don't mind. Now this lady bit, remember that all the values I had, I'm sure my mother and father tried to get me clear on what this lady business meant. But I never really understood it. But I had an idea that a lady was the dowager type person, you know, who sort of sits in a big chair in a big drawing room in front of a big fireplace. This was my little girl attitude, an idea of a lady. I still think they probably are, but anyway. I thought, of course, that she must have a little drink occasionally. She probably had a little sip of sherry. Because I didn't think anyone as fine as a lady must be, whatever she was. Could not drink at all, because by this time I decided anyone who didn't drink wasn't worth anything anyway. And I found out later from a gal in AA what a lady is. Because she had the same kind of frustration as I did. And as she was speaking one night, and I was listening to her very carefully, she said, "A little about these sherry-sipping ladies." She had the same problem I had. And she said that she was happy to note, I was fairly new when I heard her, she was very happy to note that a lot of these sherry-sipping ladies had made it into AA too. She also said that she had found out that to be a lady is to but be kind. Now, there are a few people here who know me too well for me to get away with even trying to insinuate that I'm kind all the time. But I can truthfully assure you that it's much easier to try to be kind 5 minutes at a time than it is to try to be whatever in the name of heavens I was trying to be before. And this kind of signifies AA and all of its many, many answers that have come to me because some AA was willing to share their experience with me. During those years of working, I worked in a job finally where I was had the opportunity of doing a little counseling. Now, counseling is great for alcoholics, I think, active ones. It was great for me. I loved it. Because it gave me an opportunity to shelve myself and think in terms of other people. I would go to work and I would listen to all these girls' problems, and they had them, I thought. I know today as I stand here that not one of them had as serious a problem as I had. And yet I didn't even know that I had it. And had I known that I had it, I wouldn't have known what to do about it. I used to worry a little bit about some of the advice I dished out to some of these girls when I thought I was so brilliant during those years. But I don't worry about it anymore because I was privileged to see a group of them not too long ago. And they assured me they didn't pay too much attention to me anyway, so I don't have to worry about it. I mention this because this was the means of my survival. I heard someone say not too long ago, they wonder what happened to all the important jobs that all of us had prior to AA. Well, this is true of me. This job was important. It was terribly important to me because it was a means of survival for me. I couldn't look at myself. I had to work. I had to escape into this. I selected very carefully during those 11 years the people that I drank with because I knew what happened when I drank. I didn't go out to have a couple of drinks and dinner. In fact, people that eat when they drank bored me to death. I went out to drink. I saw no reason ever to combine the two. Alcohol was very, very special. Why louse it up with food was the way I always felt about it. And so I selected carefully those people with whom I drank because I only and always drank with the idea or hope anyway that I was going to be able to get drunk. I didn't always succeed. But I did most of the time, I would say. You know, this goes along for a while, and you're not quite aware. When they say alcoholism is insidious, they are not kidding. You and I know that. I was living in a very dark world, and a very ignorant world, on this subject. I noticed that it was getting a little more difficult to get up in the morning and go to work. It was getting a little more difficult to shelve Hazel and think in terms of other people's problems. I was beginning to have this horrible pain that comes from the great conflict within the alcoholic, and we see it, you and I see it, in the sick alcoholic. We see it sometimes, and I feel it sometimes within myself today, but not like I did then, thanks to AA. That horrible pain that comes from trying to put on a picture of someone that you are on the outside, when you know that this picture is completely different from the kind of person that we are, or I was, I'll say, on the inside. This pain was getting pretty great. I couldn't put forth the effort. And then a very wonderful thing happened to me. The man that I worked for asked me to marry him. This was great. This was a wonderful way out. I didn't know it. I only know it now. He's often said, little did he know what he was in for. And I always follow that by saying, and little did I know what I was in for, that's for sure. In any event, I was privileged to be able to quit that job before they fired me. Because it would not have been long, that's but for sure. And then came the great new phase of my life where I was going to become the homemaker and the wife and all these wonderful things. I know now the thing I was looking forward to most was the fact that now I could drink and I wouldn't be bothered by all these people and their problems and all the other responsibilities that I had had. But I didn't really face this, of course. I had always had a dream that if I ever had a chance to stay home, I would learn to cook and sew and make draperies and maybe paint and, oh, do a lot of things. But after my husband went back to work, after the first week of our marriage, at 9 o'clock one Monday morning, I took a look at all the plans that I had thought I was going to carry out. And as Father Barney said so well this morning, I did a little meditating on that subject. And I didn't seem to be able to come up with any one that I should start on first. And so I thought, well, what should I do? I was alone. And I had a sudden realization at that moment that I was really alone. That I was alone in the world. Because I had been kept held up and held together by the people with whom I worked. These people were gone. And I was there. And so what do you think I did? Well, I decided I'd have a martini. So I had one. And it was great. I didn't feel alone. I felt sure that I could accomplish all the things that I'd ever dreamed of accomplishing. Everything was going to be wonderful and bright and beautiful, but about an hour later, I again felt a little alone. So, that time, I decided that I would have a drink, but I didn't put any vermouth in it. And that's how I became a gin drinker. And I drank gin for the next year and a half. Sort of round the clock during the week. 4, 5 days, you name it. As long as I could do it. Sometimes I cried, sometimes I laughed. Sometimes I made a lot of very, very foolish telephone calls. Sometimes I fell down and broke bones, and I was sort of the president of the Broken Bone Club, I guess. I remember, too, that during that time we were living in an apartment, and we had a very nice lady who lived next door to us. But all of a sudden, I was receiving calls from the superintendent saying that she wanted us to move. And I couldn't understand that I was the only one there. So I must have been making an awful lot of noise, whatever I was doing, that's for sure. But you live in this sort of deep fog, and those of you who have done it, I don't have to bother describing it to you, and those of you who haven't, I'm sorry I don't remember enough about it to say too much. I do remember that I used to write myself notes and say, "Don't call your sister," and put alongside a telephone. But you know, after I had a couple more drinks, I thought that was a ridiculous idea, so of course I called her. We know the embarrassment of having people arrive at the door and you don't remember having invited them. I remember a gal coming over one night for dinner, and Dudley was home, and he said, "I'm sorry, Dottie, Hazel's sick, she's in bed." And Dottie told me later, she took one look at him and said, "She's not sick, she's drunk." And he said, "Dottie, that's a subject I'd just as leave not discuss with you or anybody else." So Dottie left. We remember these things. We know these things. After a year and a half, though, I decided I would call AA. I never discussed the fact that I was drunk with Dudley or with anybody else. This was a very closed subject. Not at this stage. This came later. Where did I hear about AA? This I don't know. I have no idea. I had never known an alcoholic. I never knew anyone who drank like I did. I thought I was the only one in the world, but someone, I choose to feel God, sort of put the knowledge of AA in my way so that if I ever got around to asking for help, I would know about it. And I always enjoy so much knowing how people happened to come to AA, how they heard about it. I think it's one of the great miracles in my life and perhaps in all of our lives that we knew about it. And I called the New York Intergroup office, and I went in to see them the next day. They wanted to send someone to see me, but I said, "Oh, no, oh, no. I'll come to see you wherever you are." So they told me, and I got pretty dressed up for me the next day, and I went in there. And I felt very good while I was walking in there. I felt wonderful. Walking down the street to the office on the street where it's located, I knew something very great and very special and very wonderful was going to happen. I had a feeling that I should have a banner or a band or something. If I had had Maury with me, I'm sure he would have arranged it. But I went into this office and I sat down. I realized now, as I look back on it, that this was the first time in my life I ever had a desire to share a problem with someone else. And this was the release that I was just beginning to feel. This was the reason for the jubilance. This was for the good feeling that I had as I walked in. I met a wonderful gal there. She told me the grimmest, saddest, most horrible story I have ever heard from anyone in AA since. Well, when she got finished, she wouldn't let me talk. She talked. She had been told, "You know, you share your story." Well, I wanted to share mine, but I didn't have a chance because by the time she got finished, I was crying so hard over her story. And I was so grateful that she was in AA, whatever it was, that I decided this was had been a pretty wonderful experience and I would just go home now because I'd sort of had it. And she gave me a meeting list. She also asked me if I'd like to go to the hospital. Well, this horrified me. And I said, "Oh, goodness, no. I'm not that sick, you know." Well, I found out later they didn't ask everybody to go to the hospital, so I think I may have been a little sicker than I thought. In any event, I took the meeting list, and I went home. You know, AAs are pretty sneaky. About a month later, I got a note from a gal named Doris. Thank God for Doris. Who said that she was the secretary of the Jackson Heights group. She had tried to contact me because that sneaky gal at Intergroup had told her that I was down there, I guess. And she said, "I haven't been able to reach you. I have a feeling you might have used your maiden name." And she was right, I have. So I figured I don't want to get my husband and his family involved in this situation. And she said, just in the event that you might have some interest, further interest in AA, and I hope you do have, let's have lunch someday. This is my number, and signed it with love, Doris. This came as a great shock, this note. I think the thing that was most shocking about it, I know it was to me, was the fact that she ate lunch. Because I hadn't eaten lunch for years, so I can't imagine anybody eating lunch. I couldn't imagine quite what a person she was, but you've heard of many stories just like mine where I tucked the note away. And I considered it a pretty prized possession, really, but I wouldn't admit it, of course. But a year later, I called that number, and I went to the hospital. And came out of the hospital, and almost all of the things that the gal told me that day in the intergroup office would happen and could happen to me began to happen. It was during that period that I ended up in the psychiatric ward. It was during that period that I decided I would try ant abuse. This is going to be the answer for me. It was during that period that I thought adrenal cortex was going to be the answer to all my problems. Because I had a sneaking idea, if I have a disease, this is fine, but I don't need 100,000 or however many we have AAs to get me fixed up if I have a disease. A doctor ought to be able to do this, I thought. Also, I realize now as I look back that for me, I seem to have something outside of me to do this for me. This is what I was looking for. During this time, however, during that 3 years from the day I first went to the intergroup office, I sat in the back row of meetings occasionally. Now, I was a real pain in the neck to the members of the Jackson Heights group. They weren't too delighted with me. But they gave me love. You know, I think there's something about love that surpasses all understanding. I don't think this is the kind of love that I found in the Jackson Heights group. The kind of love that I found there was an understanding love. They understood me. And I knew they understood me. When I would say to them, well, you know, maybe AA's fine for you, you know, but, they would say, yes, Hazel, we know. One of the rare times that my husband was willing to speak to me at all, he asked me for the number of one of the AAs and called them. And he told me later that they said to him, you know, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when Hazel's going to get sober. And to this day, he says those were the most wonderful words he ever heard. It was during those years that this gal, Doris, kept an eye on me. She called up one day and said, Hazel, you remind me of tarnished silver. There's a lot inside, but you're sure kind of tarnished on the outside. I didn't for some reason mind her saying I was tarnished, that I knew. The thing that knew and gave me hope that she had some love for me was the fact that she said I was tarnished silver and that there was something good inside. This was the kind of love and understanding I had never known. I had perhaps known what I thought was love, but not the kind that accepts you as you are. Not the kind that accepts you only when you're all dressed up and ready to go and do something. These were the kind of people that I found here. These were the kind of people that made it possible for me, and I was the kind who was always looking for a way out. I wish they'd be real mean. Then I could go home and say, I'm not going back there anymore. Those people aren't nice in that group. But they were always smart enough never to really cross the line, you know. They always kind of kept the door open. And they were tolerant and kind. And so one Sunday afternoon, as a result of this, I'm sure they brought about, through their love, which is the power of the greatest I think we know in the world. I was trying to read the paper. I couldn't see very much. But I could see one line, thank God. And it said, the number of times that you win or lose in life is not important at all. There's only one thing important, and that's the number of times that you try. For some reason, this hit me. That I had never tried to do anything about my problem. Now, I'm sure every AA that had ever taken a look at me knew I had never tried to do anything about my problem. But the difference was that I didn't know it until that moment. Just the other day, I said to a friend of mine named Kitty, you know, if Iris doesn't get sober, she's going to lose her husband and her kids and everything else. And Kitty looked at me and said, Hazel, come off it. Iris doesn't see it that way. Don't you remember? You didn't see it that way either. And she was so right. But as of that minute, I began to know that I had never had a relationship with anybody in my entire life. I knew that only because I could almost literally and physically see a wall collapsing between me and other people. It had always been there. I don't know why it was there. I didn't put it there. I didn't even know it was there until I began to feel it fall. And as I sat there, I could hear a few of the things I had said at meetings, heard said at meetings. I could hear people say, keep an open mind. This didn't mean anything to me. My mind was completely open, in and out. It didn't stay. Nothing stayed, that's for sure. But I could remember some man who had said to keep an open heart. And all of a sudden, I seemed to know that that was the clue to my problem, that I had closed my heart. But at that moment, I knew it was open. I hadn't lost a home, and I hadn't lost a husband, thanks to AA. But I had lost all the things that money can't buy. I hadn't worked for years. I'd been too sick to work. But I lost the things that are really important to the sick alcoholic, the things that, as I say, money cannot buy. And I had the hope that maybe, maybe, I, too, could stay sober if I went back to AA. As of that moment, I had, for the first time in my life, the only qualification for membership to AA, a desire to be sober in AA. And I went to what I like to believe was my first AA meeting the next night because I was now a member. I wanted to be sober. There was a man there 6 years sober, leading the meeting. He was talking something about a rubber band. He was using a rubber band and talking about how emotionally that day he had had a problem in the office, but by remembering the slogan, Easy Does It, it seemed to sort of keep him from snapping, and he's using this rubber band, and I didn't know exactly what he was talking about, but I thought to myself, on the way home, as I walked home, I thought, you know, there must be more here than I thought, because I had never seen Joe before, and he seemed fairly bright to me. He was sober 6 years, but he's still worrying about this little slogan, Easy Does It. And I thought, gee, you know, maybe you don't learn all this in a week. Maybe it takes a little time. A lot of people say the newcomers help them a great deal in the beginning. Well, the old-timers always kind of helped me, and I consider Joe a real old-timer that night, that's for sure. He'd been sober 6 years, and that was a million as far as I was concerned. And it was a great inspiration to me to know that he was still there and he still found it interesting, he still found it helpful, and he was still growing through trying to use the AA program. Then the thing happened to me that's happened to all of you, I'm sure. I became a newcomer. Some of you are newcomers now. Thank God. It's a wonderful, wonderful phase of AA. I don't think anything can ever really begin to compare with it. I was the most important person in the group. Everybody was thrilled to death that I was sober and not calling them up at 2 o'clock in the morning anymore. And delighted, and they gave me all kinds of jobs to do, and everybody was calling me up, and it was just wonderful. And then came the big, big moment of my life when they asked me to be program chairman for our closed meetings. Well, if they'd asked me to be president of the United States, I couldn't have been more thrilled. Also that night, they elected a GSR. That was the first time I ever heard of one. And I looked around 3 times at the man they elected GSR. His name was Henry Johnson, and he wouldn't mind telling my breaking his anonymity, I'm sure, because I thought he must be pretty special. Apparently, they think he's going to be sober for 2 years because they were electing him for a job that they told us anyway he was going to serve in for 2 years. Well, I was right. It was important, but I didn't know very much about it, except I knew it must be important. I was sure of that. Well, when I was program chairman, I worked very hard. I got some real good speakers, and everything was great and fine and wonderful, and I was 12-stepping and helping everybody in the group. I thought, took kind of a dim view of some of these old-timers who weren't quite so happy to go out on these 12-step calls as I was, it seemed. And then I got a call from one of the members after one of our meetings one night, and he said he didn't like the speaker I had had at the meeting the night before. Well, this kind of shook me up. He was a good friend of mine. I didn't know what to say to him. So I just said, well, thanks, and hung up and called Doris, my sponsor, and said, what's the matter with this guy? You know, he's calling me up and complaining. She said, well, I don't know. And after all, now, she wasn't going to get in the middle of this. She's a friend of his, and so, you know, she didn't say very much. But this was a very wonderful experience for me. This was, again, a wonderful example of understanding love. Phil was aware that I was kind of going way off, you know. I was, you know, practically not a part of the group anymore. I was having an awful lot of my own ideas. But the amazing thing to me was that I didn't leave. And you know why I didn't leave the group and why I didn't get mad and why I finally decided to even change a couple of speakers, which was a brand new experience for me, you can be sure. Because I didn't have any place else to go. And I knew it. Because, you know, a lot of people say, what is AA? I think AA is a million things. It's to each and every one of us deep in our heart something a little different. Some people say AA is recovery, unity, and service. Some people say AA is the General Service Board. Some people say it's the General Service Conference. Some people say it's 12-step work. Some people say it's carrying the message. Some people say it's a way of life. But to me, as of that moment, I came to know that AA was life itself to me. And I hope I never get around to kidding myself into believing anything else. Because I was dead when I arrived here, and I know you share that experience, many of you, with me. And without AA, I'd be dead again. No question about it. And so I stayed. Thank God. And I began to feel a part of a group. This was a new experience. And Cliff described to you the wonderful traditions that came to be mine. Came to be mine to try to learn to work as part of a group. And I loved every minute of it. And then all of a sudden, another new gal arrived in the group. And everybody thought she was wonderful. And she got to be the program chairman. And she began to get all the calls. Everybody's walking around being very grateful that she's sober, and isn't she pretty, and isn't she this, and isn't she that. Well, this was fine. I went along with them, but only to a degree. You know what happens to me. I mean, these newcomers are great, but, you know, they must not forget the rest of us. And Joe, the man who had been leading the closed meeting the night, my first meeting, must have suspected this. You know, as I say, these AAs are sneaky. They kind of read your mail. He came up to me one night and he said, what's the matter? No more red velvet carpet? Well, I was a little indignant for a second, but I never said anything back to Joe because, you know, he was too important to me. He and Doris were always very special. I didn't want to get in any trouble because I figured if I ever needed them, boy, you know, I needed them. And he was not kid about these friendships. But on the way home that night, I thought, you know, Joe's right. Now, what do I do? Well, you know, we talked a lot about Al-Anon here and how great Al-Anon is, and they're wonderful, and the Al-Ateens are great, and everything's fine. This is true, but as far as I'm concerned, I have to have a little personal experience associated with almost anything for it to have real meaning. Al-Anon has a very special meaning to all of us, too, and I'm sure Al-Ateens do, too. And the special meaning that Al-Anon has to me is that at that particular time, when I needed help, because I was coming into a phase which I kind of like to think of as the middle timer, which I'm still in, where I could have gone a lot of different ways. But this wonderful Al-Anon gal, who was Joe's wife, knew a lot about the intergroup office in New York, and she said to me, why don't you go down and volunteer at the New York intergroup office, where we use volunteers? We have paid staff, too, but they also use quite a few volunteers there for calls. Well, I was afraid to go. I hadn't ridden the subway into New York by myself for a long time. And she suspected it. I said, oh, I'd love to go, but she knew I was phony, and so she kept insisting, and she kept calling me. I'll go in with you, she said. And she did. And that's how I became a volunteer at the New York Intergroup office. These are tangible, life-saving events that happen in our lives. This isn't talking about how wonderful it is. I love the way Marty Mann says, you know, we're not playing with marbles, we're playing with lives. Because it's really so true. At that same time, there were three of us in the group at about the same phase that I was. One of them became active in institutional work. The other one never found a way to go, stayed away from AA, started drinking about a year later, and is now dead. Why? Sponsorship, I believe. I'm very grateful, and I know that many of you in this room today, someone took the time to say, would you like to be a GSR? Would you like to be a part of one of the central offices? Would you like to be a committee member? Yes, and would you like to be a delegate? And maybe would you like to be a trustee? Or maybe would you like to serve as part of this wonderful Desert Roundup committee? What would you like to do? These are the people I think that need direction and need help, and I'm so grateful that I received it. Because there I began to learn new things. I began to find out that there were some, 200 or 300 groups in the greater New York area. They all had the same problems our group had. It was as though I had been living in a box that was lined with mirrors for a long time. And these mirrors were very slowly becoming windows. And the New York Intergroup office and the experience there, which all the groups made possible, of course, opened many, many windows. And then not too many years ago, I was given the privilege of becoming a staff member of your General Service Office. Many of you have been there, I'm grateful to say. I hope many more of you and all of you will be able to come. Because the greatest thrill that I get every day in going to work is to know, whereas at one time I thought I was the only drunk in the whole world, I know now there's a whole floor being devoted to the care and carrying of the message to the still sick alcoholic. And this is all done through your efforts. If I could briefly describe the General Service Office, I would say I think of it as a treasure chest. A great, glorious, wonderful, golden treasure chest filled with the millions and millions of miracles that are and have been AA in the past 30 years. Each of your recovery stories and mine, each of the millions of experiences which Cliff talked about, and how we learned to live together and how the traditions came to be formed. Each of the millions of ways in which each of you carry the message of AA. For the past 2 years, it's been my privilege to serve as conference secretary. And in this effort and privilege, I've had the opportunity of being in touch with a lot of you. And just before this meeting started, I met a couple of committee members from this particular area who have been conducting workshops. And those workshops are an awful lot of fun, I know. I know, too, that AA will always survive, no problem, as long as you and I have a desire to continue carrying the message. I think it's a very wonderful thing for us to have the privilege of getting together in a roundup such as this. I've heard of the Desert Roundup because I was also conference secretary when Jack came back with news of it to the conference, the first one. When Maury and Joe invited me here, I couldn't quite grasp for a minute, you know, I'm not so sharp as some of the Phi Beta Kappas we have around, that this was the Desert Roundup that I had heard of from Jack. And yesterday, as the day went on, I thought people are coming and coming and coming and coming. I think one of the wonderful things about this is that the gal who is serving as secretary of this roundup committee has had just about a year's sobriety. And in talking with her, I couldn't help but relive my own fortunate experience in knowing that she's no longer a real newcomer. It looks, and we hope, she's going to stay around for a long time. But somebody took the time to ask her if she would like to engage in some other kind of activity in the carrying of the message to the sick alcoholic. These are the kind of things, the including of others. This has always been my experience in AA. I could never thank Maury and all of you enough, but I think you know exactly how I feel. And now as we leave here, I'm going to steal a thought that I got from a million other people, I'm sure. We come into another area, because I always have a little bit of a sad feeling when these great roundups are over, this great experience of all of us being together. But I don't anymore, because someone gave me a new thought. That while we're together here, we meet and we love and we share our experience, strength, and hope. When we leave here, we have another area, the area of reflection. And I'm sure that without, in the many years to come, you and I may not even remember each other's names. But we will have a knowledge within us that because of this wonderful roundup, our lives have been deeply enriched and the bond of AA within us, each one, deeply strengthened. Thanks.